I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Today, we're joined by Professor Leslie Wood at Northwest University. She is a leading voice in participatory action research. She's an NRF-rated scholar committed to using education as a tool for social justice and transformation. Her work empowers communities, challenges traditional research norms, and strengthens capacity in academia. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Amalia. Thank you for having me, inviting me.
Prof Wood, your research champions a more transformative, inclusive, and democratic paradigm in education. Please tell us what initially drew you to participatory action research as a tool for social change.
Yeah, that's before I came into the education discipline, I was a social worker. I wasn't in academia. And I was down in the Eastern Cape at the time, and I was invited to join a new program that they developed at the university where they wanted the skills that a social worker could bring. We were working with students that didn't quite make the mark and needed to do like a foundation phase, but not foundation early childhood foundation. So we had a lot of foreign students from Botswana, China, and also South African. And so part of that course was life skills and stuff, you know, mentoring students. So as a social worker, social justice is important to me. And I found that I came into higher education at a time when HIV and AIDS was rampant. And that, you know, so there was a lot of social justice issues and teachers were struggling to deal with it. So to me, I see research, it has to be research as social change, and participatory research allows that because it's not just doing research on people, it's doing research with people to help them improve their own lives much more than just reaching the outcomes of the research, which was usually set by the researcher. In this research, we set it together, and so people learn about themselves, their situations, and how to bring about change even when we're not there.
It's quite a different approach. And staying on this theme, you have been instrumental in developing participatory action learning and action research, so PALAR. And you've highlighted, I think, some of those elements in the previous question of working with people as opposed to working on people through research. But could you just elaborate more on how that differs from traditional research methods, and also perhaps why it matters in an African context?
Okay, so it's different than the paradigm being the way we think about the world and our relationships with people and how knowledge is created and the values that drive us to do research. So participatory action research is perhaps better known than PALAR, but it sees people as capable beings. And of course, we want them to learn and develop as a result of the research. That is PAR. But if we integrate action learning with it, which is learning with others, from others, focusing on real world problems and learning from experience, where you know you learn something and you create knowledge, co-create knowledge, and you try it out and you come back and you critically reflect on it. And that is so important, I found, and in our context, because socio-historical oppression and so on, people are not used to voicing their opinions. Specifically when you're working, you know, in the poorest communities or which have been impoverished by our past and by systemic oppression. So their voices have been silent, especially women and young people, and PALAR gives them a voice and the confidence to use it because we work in small groups and we spend a lot of time on relationship building and helping people build the confidence to actually participate authentically. If we don't do that, what happens? The researcher says, oh, I'm doing participatory action research, goes in, they don't participate well for many reasons, and then the researcher just says, oh, well, I just need to take over this and off they go, and it's back to the traditional paradigm where the researcher is making all the decisions. So I think in this African context, it's very important, or any context where people have been marginalized and don't have the confidence and not have the opportunity to learn how to voice their opinion and to work together.
And we often hear in different contexts or situations that the best people to ask or to be aware of a problem or think about solutions are actually the people that are experiencing the problem, as opposed to someone coming in from the outside and saying, Eureka, this is a solution.
Yes, and then more sustainable because, how many theses and other articles do we have that are sitting there on the shelf making recommendations? The government should do this. The people must do this. Data. Nobody does it. Huh? So we, if the people decide themselves what they want to do, they create those knowledge, this knowledge, and they disseminate the knowledge because part of power is recognition of their learning, and they have the opportunity then to create manual teaching manuals or do workshops or host events where they can share the knowledge and change policy, perhaps within a school or within a higher education institution or within a specific context, not necessarily national policy. Although the work that we are doing now in early childhood, because I have a chair in early childhood at the moment, which I'm approaching and using PALA as a community project, we, for instance, some of our my master's students participants, they presented their research at the ETTP CETA, who funds the chair, research colloquium. And they said, we have started an ECD center community of practice, and this is what they want to promote all over the country. And there were a lot of important people from the DBE and different, stakeholders that have that, so it gives them a voice. And so we can influence national policy as well. Not always, but we try.
It's a tough one, having that ability to influence and push through things, which requires quite a bit of persistence. With your social worker background, I know that you're an advocate for research as a means to disrupt social injustices. Can you tell us about some of the social injustices in education that concern you the most, and how you've seen research actively transform, or as we've just been talking, influence some of these issues?
So as I said earlier, I started at a time when HIV was on rampant, and we needed to find a way to help teachers cope with the social impacts of HIV because the kids in the class who were traumatized by their parents' death, they themselves had perhaps were HIV positive, or they had relatives who died and so on. So there was a lot of issues and gender issues as well. Women in this country bear the multiple burden of being poor, black, and female. And we all know about the gender-based violence. So we've worked with people. It was so interrelated with HIV prevention and dealing with the issues. You couldn't separate them. So we did a lot of work with teachers, helping them to not just to prevent sort of education, but to support and care and provide a more enabling space for kids to deal with it too and to learn about it. Just now, I'm working in the area of early childhood education, which is privatized, which is, most of the ECD centers are run by women as a means of income for themselves and for others. It's a very important part of the economy. But of course, they're suffering so much trauma. We've just completed some research on helping them identify what's impacting on their wellness, and then how they can work together to improve their wellness. We've done that with teachers, but it's a different situation when you're dealing with women who have no qualifications, who are not recognized, who are paid sub-minimum wages to look after children, and then go home and are traumatized by financial pressure, by relationship, gender-based violence, by families coming and saying, "Oh, you're working, you must help us." And I mean, they're earning practically nothing. So all these issues, they're being traumatized, and they're working with babies from 0 to 5 years old. So can you imagine how that trauma can be transferred? Because we know about intergenerational trauma within families, but it happens within communities. And so we really need to do something. So we're working hard to give these women a voice. We have already, they've one group in Phuket have started Rekha Pansalary, a community of practice or an ECD hub as we want to do it. And we're looking to establish these ECD hubs at local level around where they can come together and they can support each other, because the research shows just working with them and getting them to draw their experiences about their well-being, and they speak to each other about it, speak to us about it. They said this is helping so much. So we're going to work with them so that they can kind of formalize ECD hubs that will not only look at skills training, but which it will do, and working with local communities, because the DBE is doing wonderful work in and setting policies and qualifications and everything for this sector, but they can't fund it at the moment 100%, and they're definitely not from 0 to 3 year olds for a long time. So we have to bring change from the ground up. So national policies have to be converted to more contextually relevant needs on the ground.
We had an interesting conversation last year with the current Minister of Basic Education, and she was talking about transformation in the education sector from how, in a way, early childhood development had been neglected and there'd been a focus on primary, but emphasizing that if we don't get ECD right, that we
I
lose
think
out on that foundational level, which sets the trajectory going ahead.
and there's a social justice issue, because the people who can afford quality education in this country get wonderful education. I mean, it's not different from any other country. But those who can't afford it, they start behind and they stay behind. You can just see the digital divide. You go in and work with these people, some of them don't even know how to turn a computer on. They can work a phone, but they don't know how to use it to advance. There's so much out there that early childhood practitioners, for instance, could download lesson plans, ways of dealing. There are but they're just not aware of it or able to do it. So we need to equalize it. And if you the one of the famous quotations that we always use is a guy called Heckman in the States, who I think he was at Harvard Business School or economics, and he actually did all this quantitative research, which shows the best investment a country can make for economic growth is investing in the early childhood education of the poorest of the poor, not in the rich or the better off for the middle class, but in the real working class areas.
Important quote and so crucial. I wish that countries would adopt policies that really emphasize that. And because you know what, there's smart people all over, and poverty shouldn't be a factor that prevents you from moving ahead.
Yeah, and this country's got the highest Gini coefficient, which means the biggest gap between the rich and the poor. And it's not getting smaller, it's growing bigger. And another area that I'm working in is with what we call NEET. And I don't like labeling people, but it's just a term that's used. It's not an education, employment, or further training. So you have, all these young people just leaving school and sitting around and destroying their own self-esteem, their own self-image, becoming depressed. That's a huge mental health issues. And then also turning to more not such healthy ways to earn money, like crime, or turning to cope with their feelings, drug abuse, joining gangs, whatever. So that's another area we've been working in, especially with young women. And we've seen how just working with them through this pilot process, and it takes a while to build the trust and to get them to trust each other, never mind us as researchers. And one of my PhD students, Nosipho Nxumalo, has been working with them, and the change is amazing. And out of 13 women, at least 10 of them are now either joined the army, it's opened up a little hairdressing business. And when I say a business, I mean online social media, doing hair, opened up a tutoring center, and so on. Or gone back for actually applied to university and knew how to fill in the forms correctly and got accepted. So there's all these examples of these young women now believing in themselves and supporting each other to do this.
That's such a rewarding piece of work because I can speak from experience, having done a thesis, and it probably just lives on the shelf somewhere, that your student has been able to empower these women to go forward, believe in themselves, and for them to apply their skills and job create.
And hopefully to carry on with those groups because she is an academic herself. She was my master's student. She got a job at the university, and she's an example herself of someone who came from a township in KZN and had not the easiest upbringing with her parents dying young, and yet managed to make it. So, that's what I would like to do, get more young researchers in here who really understand the community because they've been part of it better than I can as a privileged woman who's never really had to live in those circumstances or understand it, who doesn't speak the language. And that's what, I'd like to focus on. There are a lot of promising young academics coming in and mentoring them and helping them to see how this kind of approach to research can help them to bring about change. And in the process we grow doing this, it's not just one-sided. It's not just changing other people. We can't change them. They have to change themselves. But we change and we become more empathic and understanding and everything in the process. So it's just wonderful.
It sounds like trust is a key ingredient in building partnerships between academia and the communities that you work with.
Yeah.
Are there any other elements that you think are important in these relationships?
Well, trust comes from, is I think the difference between this and traditional research. Traditional research is really objective. The researcher shouldn't get involved, and we mustn't impose our bias. And so we gather information from people, qualitative or quantitative work. But so we are not involved, but in this you are involved. So you have to be authentic. To build trust, you have to really care. I always say when I'm doing my workshops, if you don't care, please go, don't do this. Go away and do another kind of research. It's got to come from values that are grounded in you. You have to, parlor to me, is a way of life. And I wasn't the first to say that, but that's what it is. It's more, and we say it's a paradigm, it's a way of looking at the world, but it's also a research design. Okay, because it guides you, the structure to it. And I often get from examiners when my students write this, but how can it be both? It's just so different from the normal way of seeing it. It takes people a while to understand that it's we have to embody the values. And that way we build trust. And the other wonderful thing about it is that we can value Indigenous knowledge systems, local knowledge systems. We don't know what works there. We know what is acceptable and we don't know what is acceptable and what is not in a specific culture. And cultures are not like standardized within one township to the next township. There's different things going on. So local knowledge as well. And being a collective, it's all about working together with other people, which is so important. We're finding that, and when people do that, and that's not something that's common, we've found this neat project is part of a larger DSI, Department of Social Innovation and NRF funded project that I'm leading, and we've got various faculties involved, and we're working with males as well, but this particular PhD was just looking at the females, and we see when they work together, they don't want to work together, they don't trust each other, they are very much in competition because the resources are so scarce. So I'm scared that if I get give you some knowledge that I've got or some skills or resources, then I'm going to be left with nothing. And of course, that is not the case. The more you give, the more you asked. And what if all research says, like, who benefits from this research and how? That should be the deciding factor of the value of the research. What impact does it make? Not how many people did you reach, and what recommendations can you make, but what real impact are we having there? And I think that for me, you know, if all research was, and I know not all research can be like that, we still need experimental, you know, but within education, we're wanting to really make a difference and change the system, which is struggling, not just early childhood, but the whole system. I think that that's great. And also, you have to be adaptable when you're doing this research and flexible. You do it in cycles. The first cycle is usually about what's going on. And then if something comes up there that is different from what we wrote in our proposal to our committees, then we have to be adaptable to change. We have to go with what people want. So yeah, that's just some of the issues.
Rockwood, you are very passionate about Pella as a methodology and a tool for practice. You've built up various
Yes.
networks, and one of them, for instance, is your work in the UNESCO Knowledge for Change Hub, which shows that there's a very strong aspect of collaboration. Can you tell us what the global academic community can learn from African models of community-based research?
I think maybe sort of now in my last question, where I said it's relational ethics rather than just research. Creating theory is important, and but we need to look at the, you know, the social aspects and the ethical aspects of the research as well. It's not just transactional. Okay, it's built on trust, long-term relationships, mutual respect. Okay, so that's different. As I said, it's embedded knowledge systems using indigenous knowledge and working with people. And then decentralized leadership. Oh, we shouldn't be in charge. Okay, normally we have to go in and start the process and facilitate it. But when once we see people, you know, learning and able to facilitate the process themselves, stepping back and letting them do it, it's not hierarchical structures. You know, we have a very much hierarchy in research and so on, but we want to move away from that. And I think one big difference too is the spiritual and moral dimensions of knowledge. In a lot of African contexts, knowledge is not separate from the spiritual. I mean, even if you look and if you look at indigenous contexts, such as in Canada with the First Nations people and so on. It's very much part of their spiritual outlook on life. You can't separate how they see the world, their paradigm from that knowledge creation and what they do with their knowledge. Yeah, so I think we're coming to a time where knowledge is very much available out there. We have artificial intelligence, which is a blessing and something we must be very careful with in both ways. So how can we, yeah, we have to start looking, I think, at more of the existential and the ethical issues around knowledge production. And that's what research is, creating knowledge rather than just creating knowledge. Because we can get all the facts in 2 seconds from ChatGPT. We can get this, we can get that. I think that's the difference in the African way of doing it, not just going in, getting research for our own purposes or just to, you know, to give influence policy, whatever, but also for the benefit of the people there, leaving it much better than it was when we went to the situation.
You've tapped into the aspect of AI, and earlier we were talking about the digital divide and how people who don't have access get left further and further behind. Educational technology is one of your areas of interest. In your view, how do you think technology can be harnessed in ways which are inclusive, equitable, and locally relevant, particularly in under-resourced environments?
Well, I would agree that is one of my areas of skill. Not at all. There are people much more skilled than me in that. But you have to keep up. You have to try your best to use it where you can. For instance, with the NEET project, and we're working in Gauteng and Kuma mostly, and in townships where there's maybe about 60-70% of the kids are unemployed because they're farm and mining areas, which are now on a downturn at the moment. So we realized that before we could expect them to actually do what they just wanted to do, i.e., was to improve the employability skills and then work with people, young people at school. That was the grade 10s and to 12s at the after school programs to teach them what they've learned, kind of thing. But we realized they had to, before they can do anything in this, they had to learn how to use technology. So one of the first trainings that they had was we asked the library staff to come in and do information literacy with them, and then digital literacy as well, and then how to use that to write CVs, and how to use it to advertise if they wanted to start a business or something, how to use all these nice AI apps to create social media adverts and so on. So that's a practical example of what we're doing in the community with the childhood. They have to learn how to use the computer, but how to use it because the DBE is going to be coming in with all these online forms they have to fill in and report, etc. How to use it in a practical way. So I think that's, wherever we're working, we realize we digital literacy and using AI to help them improve their work is something essential. We can't just go in and do research and forget or capacity building and forget about that because it's so essential to closing that digital divide. I mean, yeah. Unfortunately, we do try and provide computers with our funding where we can and so on, but they're often abused or they're stolen and working with schools it's a bit easier because we've got more security. But if we give people the skills, they can even use the phone in a way that you and I probably could have. The young people are very quick to catch on to that. Yeah.
Turning towards more of a personal note, your career has evolved constantly and you've assumed various leadership roles or initiated projects and taken the lead on them. For example, you served as the president of both the South African Education Research Association, as well as the Education Association of South Africa. Can you tell us what have been some of the changes that you've observed in the landscape, especially in terms of gender equity?
Yeah, I think there's many more women in leadership now, positions, many more deans of faculties, for instance, and DVCs, deputy vice chancellors, and vice chancellors. Actually, I never really see myself as a woman first. I've always just seen myself as an academic, and I think that has a lot to do with it. Don't say, oh, I'm a woman and I'm not allowed to do that, or people won't expect me to do that. You're a person. Have you happen to be a woman? And as a woman, I think you bring they do say that the preferred employees of the future, they said this a few years ago, will be women. Because as more and more technology and stuff comes into business, there's going to be a need for personal skills. And women seem to, be better at that than men. And be more rather than hierarchical, have a flatter structure within their teams, are better at teamwork. Women can multitask, as we all know, and perhaps the way men struggle. So I think we listen to others, make allies where you can. How did I get to be? I don't really know how I came. I'm as you say, I'm passionate. So in the ASA, I was invited to join that. That was mostly women led, the ASA, Educational Association of South Africa, very strong women that I've been working closely with in projects around HIV and AIDS. So that was just an invite into there. And then when they wanted to start SAERA, which was started to be, the ASA was originally very Afrikaans. It's not anymore, but it was at that time, or people saw it as that. So they wanted to do a more inclusive. So some of the other education associations amalgamated into this new one. And I was just passionate about that. And because I'd been president of EASA, then I was invited, I think, onto the committee. And then it just went from there. But I did not look around the table and say, how many men, how many women are here? I've never done that. I think you just have to believe in yourself as a person. But definitely women, there are quotas. We have to have so many women in leadership and so on. So I think that the whole system is changing to recognize that women are just as, are even better in many cases than men in leadership positions. Of course, there are many barriers still for younger women who are having babies and so on if they can't afford full-time childcare or whatever. So those thing barriers still exist. But I think in spite of that, I didn't come into academia until late in life. And so you can still do a lot and in a short period of time. If you're passionate and you work hard, working hard is very important as well.
Dovetailing with that question, one question I ask all my guests is about some of the factors of their success. Can you tell us what have been some of your key drivers?
I think not being afraid to take a risk. When I got into academia just through networking. Okay, so I was a social worker, and someone at the university had worked with me before and asked me to come. And at that point, I was a single parent with two young children. So for me, the difference in salary and looking back, my salary the university offered me wasn't that great, but it was double what I was getting in social work. So I said, okay, this is something that I can maybe do well. And at the time, I was doing a master's in health and welfare management. So I think having a broad overview from my first degree was in humanities, then I did social work, then I did health management, and then came into education. So don't be afraid to kind of widen your horizon and not just say, I'm in education. So I have the fact that I wasn't a teacher ever. Teacher in the school, I think, has helped rather than hindered my progress because I've got a broader view. And then we were when I decided, oh well, I'm at university now. I can study for free, so I may as well do my doctorate. I did it in education, and then they were looking for somebody to do HIV education. Faculty was looking for somebody to do a whole program, a 10-module program on HIV and AIDS in education. Nobody in education would do it. They said it's a health issue, nothing to do with us. And the stigma around HIV, I think, put a lot of people off. So my promoter, who said, well, she knows somebody who might do it because she knew my social work background and I'd just finished my PhD. So I said, well, sure. At that time, I knew nothing about HIV. But don't just say yes. When you're offered fantastic opportunities, say yes. And you can learn how to do it in a very short period of time. It's not, and I think that is the biggest thing is looking for opportunities. When opportunities are given to you, grab them with both hands, work hard, and make meaningful connections with like-minded people. You don't get success by working on your own. There's an African proverb that says, if you want to go far, go. If you want to go fast, go on your own. If you want to go far, walk at the pace of others or walk with others. And that's what I think too. I do collaborative research, so I try to collaborate with people not only in South Africa but all over the world. Even in this ECD chair, it's built on collaboration. We're working with three other universities. We're working with NGOs and ECD centers.
And lastly, as we close out our conversation today, please share a few words of inspiration that you'd like to pass on to girls and young women who are listening to us on the continent.
Yeah, I think as I said just now, don't see yourself primarily as a woman and think that that is a disadvantage. See yourself as a professional, as an expert in your field, who is very capable. You have everything you need inside you to succeed if you believe in yourself. you look at the successful people about the world, some of them don't have qualifications, some of them came from poor backgrounds, but what did they have was self-belief and a passion and a purpose in life. And in action research in general, we always say, don't be afraid to make mistakes. That's how you learn. We all make mistakes. I've made many myself. But critically reflect on what did I do here and what can I do differently next time to make it. Do what you love. Do more of what you love. If you don't enjoy your work, then you won't be good at it. But if you love it, you will be good. And the money will come. Don't chase money. Chase your passion and be kind to others, but most of all, be kind to yourself, because we tend to beat ourselves up, especially as women, I think. And shine where you are, even if sometimes you think you're in the wrong place. If when you look back 5 years later, you'll say, "But that's why that happened. That's how life works. That's what I've learned." Don't worry and panic, but just do your best and be the best person that you can be. I think that's it. Very glib, maybe, very sort of, it's easy to say this. It's not e so easy to live it. But I think if you just try and abide, and as time goes on, it'll get easier and easier. I just think get yourself a good mentor. That's an important thing. And it doesn't have to be somebody in your workplace. My best mentors, well, the first one was my promoter, Bob Tiller Olivier. Wonderful woman, taught me more about life, taught me as much about life as about being a professional in academia. And Prof. Orton Zubrisker, I have to mention the names in case somebody tells them, somebody's listening, because they've just been wonderful in my life. And the same with her. She taught me how to be a better person, not just to be a better academic. And I think if you can find people like that who are generous with their time, with their knowledge, and work with them, then the sky's your limit.
Thank you very much. I think those are fantastic words, pearls of wisdom, and also providing that reassuring note that whatever you're doing now may reap the dividends down the line.
No. Thank you. It's
Thanks
been a
for
pleasure.
joining us. You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and we have been talking to Professor Leslie Wood, who is at the Northwest University.